Hey everybody, welcome to a very timely episode of Back to School with Maz Jobrani. Today we have Glenn Kirshner. He's a former federal prosecutor. You might know him from a previous episode. He's been on the show before. This guy is a wealth of knowledge. He's got a show on YouTube called Justice Matters. I want you to follow that show. It's an amazing show where he talks about all the legal matters of the day. Today, he's here with us to talk about, number one, about the Kyle Rittenhouse case and all of its repercussions. So he's going to analyze that for us. Secondly, he's going to talk about all of the cases against Donald Trump. What's going to happen to Donald Trump? You want to know? He's got the answers. And lastly, he's going to tell us about the January 6th cases and when all of those wazoos or numbnuts or knuckleheads are going to get what they have coming. So he's going to tell us a lot. It's like a law. This is like a law class with entertainment involved. So sit tight, hang tight, share it with your friends. Let's go talk to Glenn Kirshner and more right now on Back to School with Maz Jobrani.
Maz Jobrani.
Hey.
Jobrani Maz. Oh, Maz Jobrani.
Hey, Jobrani.
Mazzy, Mazzy. Oh, Maz, 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 Maz.
Hey.
I got a podcast. Oh.
Back to School. Yeah.
Hey guys, your mind is one of the most important parts of your body. Our sponsor, BetterHelp, provides customized and affordable online therapy, so it's never been easier to prioritize your mental health. Back to School listeners get 10% off their first month at betterhelp.com/school. That's BetterHelp.com/school. Give yourself BetterHelp. Hey everybody, welcome to Back to School with Maz Jobrani. I am Maz Jobrani. This is my sidekick, Tehran. How are you, T?
I'm great.
If you are a listener or a viewer of the show, we thank you for supporting it. Keep supporting it. Keep watching it. If it's your first time, then welcome to the show. So last week, everybody, the whole nation was waiting to find out what's going to happen with Kyle Rittenhouse. And the more I watched it, the more I felt and knew that he's going to be found not guilty. It just was going in that direction. But still, when the decision came down that this 17-year-old at the time had used an assault rifle, gone into a protest slash what had been several nights of protests and some looting and rioting, and he showed up and put himself in that situation, and then in the process ends up killing two people because of some confrontations that take place and injuring another with his gun. It was still heartbreaking to see that he wasn't held accountable for the things that happened that night. So as a nation, I think a lot of people, well, one side was heartbroken, the other side that are hardcore gun types were saying, well, this is great. Now, you know, we can all go into these riots with our guns and quote unquote defend ourselves and really shoot people. Tehran, how did you feel when you saw the court decision come down?
It's interesting. So I wasn't as quote unquote upset as people in regards to the verdict. I understood the verdict, maybe because of my legal background, maybe because I understand how things play out. My concern was the concept that if Kyle Rittenhouse was Black, brown, Muslim, or any other type of minority, they wouldn't have even made it to the courthouse. They would have been shot on sight by the same police that waved Kyle along. And that was a big part. And secondly, I was very upset in regards to the fact that it took away from why there was a protest or any rioting in the first place. The concept of Jacob Blake being a young man who was shot by the police in Kenosha, in a series of people who've been shot by the police in Kenosha, after being tasered, was shot 7 times in the back and now is paralyzed for the rest of his life. That we've forgotten about that aspect of why it even came to this conclusion in the first place.
Yeah, it's all very tragic. So there's videos out there and you can read about it, but it all goes about this guy, Jacob Blake, who I guess had shown up at his girlfriend or wife or ex-wife's house to get the kids, and there was some violence happening there, and then they called the cops and they said that this guy's, you know, being violent or abusive towards his ex, or some confrontation going on between the man and the woman involved, and then he's got his kids in the car, and then the cop shows up and there's a video of the cop shooting Jacob Black as he's going into his car. And I guess I read an article that said Jacob Blake had a knife that the cop saw, but still his back is to the cop and he's going in the other direction. So that's tragic in itself. And then for the protests to start and then for everything to escalate. And it gets to a point where I read this article and I shared it with Tehran at New York Times, did a great article about how there was a lot of conservative radio shows talking about how they should go and patrol in the streets. And they were saying, well, if the Democratic Wisconsin governor isn't going to send in the National Guard, we should go and patrol. And all of this, again, reminds you that words do matter. So if you're on a radio show or you got a podcast or you're an influencer of some sort, if you put it out in the world and say, we should go patrol these things, we should show up with guns. Now, you might even be saying it. One of the ladies that was a radio host was saying we should go with guns and show up there to provoke the governor of Wisconsin to then send in the National Guards. She was saying somehow in a convoluted way, by us showing up on the streets, maybe the National Guards will show up. But still, this gets to a point where it's a seed of an idea. Then the next thing you know, there's Facebook pages. These guys were creating Facebook pages and they were all coming on there and going, all right, let's go, let's meet, let's go police this riot. And the unfortunate message that all this sends is that next time there's a protest, you're going to end up with a bunch of guys with AR-15s waiting. And it just, all it does is escalate.
Well,
so
I wonder what would happen if there was a KKK meeting or in Charlottesville with the Nazi meetings. A group of black men went there with guns and just stood there and said, hey, we're just exercising our rights. We have weapons. This is Virginia, an open carry state. We have guns and we're standing here. And then someone attacked them and they shot two or three or five white people. What would have happened?
Yeah, I don't know. That's kind of like what the Black Panthers were doing when they would show up at different things, I think in California. And the
exactly. We saw what happened with them. We saw what happened. The FBI infiltrated them and everyone was arrested and everyone was put in jail and under the jailhouse because of that. No, and they were just simply exercising their rights. They were organizing, which is a First Amendment right. They had weapons, which is a Second Amendment right. And America didn't band together to say, hey, why are we not defending the Constitution as they have in cases of George Zimmerman or Kyle Rittenhouse? That's the problem.
You're right, my brother. And that's why we have Glenn Kirshner here today with us to explain some of this stuff, get into it. It's an actually very, very informative and I think he presents the issues in a very entertaining way where you can definitely understand it all. And hopefully it'll inspire you to read about it more. And let's see what else we can do as just regular folks. With that said, Tehran and I are on tour. Tehran, how do people find you?
I am Tehran and on tour with Maz Jobrani.
I'm at Maz Jobrani across the board. Let me know what you think of these shows. Check them out. We had Jason Rezaian before on last week's episode. I want you to listen to all the previous episodes. Share this with your friends. With you, we grow. With you, we grow. That's going to be my new motto. With you, we grow. Tell five people to listen to this. Pass it on. Let's educate. Let's have fun learning. Let's do it. See you on tour. Now let's go talk to Glenn Kirshner on Back to School with Maz Jobrani.
Back to school. Yeah.
Glenn Kirshner, thank you for joining us again on Back to School with Maz Jobrani. You're still bald. You're still beautiful. We love you. Thanks for coming.
Hey, my pleasure. Happy to be with you guys.
All right. So here's Dara's question about the Kyle Rittenhouse stuff. Here we go.
Hi, Mr. Kirshner. I have a question for you. What were the gun laws that allowed Kyle Rittenhouse to be found innocent for what he did?
Yeah, so great question. The trouble is America seems to be determined to sacrifice the lives of men and women, boys and girls, in our determination to worship at the altar of unrestricted gun rights. It takes more to drive a car or register to vote or order a beer in many ways than it takes to get your hands on a gun. And as long as we refuse to put any reasonable restrictions on gun access, we can expect more dead folk. And for whatever reason, that seems to be an acceptable outcome to large swaths of the American population, something that I will never understand. I understand people want guns to hunt. They want guns for self-protection. But, you know, when you see a 17-year-old boy inserting himself into a volatile situation like he is some, you know, free-range law enforcement agent or vigilante, this is exactly what we should expect. People getting shot, people getting hurt, people getting killed. The reality is, even if you are possessing a gun illegally, our laws say you can still use that gun in self-defense. And, you know, there are some, I think, important public policy considerations behind that. If I don't fill all the paperwork out appropriately and I get a gun and it turns out maybe I have it illegally, even if only technically illegally, and then I use it in legitimate self-defense, well, you know, you can kind of see where the equities fall out on something like that. But a 17-year-old boy running around a protest with an assault rifle, a weapon of war, you know, this ended up exactly as I think we could have expected. So the gun laws are part of the problem. The law of self-defense should perhaps be revisited, because it's really hard for the prosecutors to disprove self-defense beyond a reasonable doubt. And hopefully the Ahmed Arbery case comes out with a better result, because it looks like those three men were hunting Mr. Arbery. But where I come down as a career prosecutor is we do have to accept the jury's verdict, even if we don't respect it. I can't tell you how many times, Maz, I've stood up on the courthouse steps after I lost the case and said, you know, the system has spoken and we're duty bound to accept the result, even if we don't agree with it, even if there has been no justice for the victims. These are tough times.
Didn't there used to be, and maybe there used to be an assault rifle ban for a while. What happened to that? Why it just ran out and they just didn't renew it?
Yeah, it had a sunset provision. I think it was signed into law by Bill Clinton, but it had an automatic sunset provision. So it expired. And the truth about the assault weapon ban is that it banned importation of assault weapons, but it really didn't stop the production of assault weapons. So it felt it was a feel-good kind of public policy vehicle, but I wonder how much gun violence it actually deterred.
And this gun that he had, the reason it was illegal was because someone else bought it and gave it to. No, he didn't. I was a little confused. I thought he used his bailout money to go buy it, or he gave it to someone and someone bought it for him because he was too young. Or that didn't even play into this case at all?
I say it didn't really play into it. Whether the gun was legally possessed or not, it almost becomes beside the point when the question is, did he have a lawful right to self-defense? In other words, self-defense has two requirements. It has a subjective and an objective. What I mean by that is the evidence has to show that the gunman had an actual, honest, subjective belief that he was in imminent risk of death or serious bodily injury, and that he needed to use deadly force to repel the attack. And that actual subjective belief had to be reasonable. So there's the subjective and the objective. So it really becomes beside the point whether he was possessing the gun lawfully or not. It boils down to, did he have a right to exercise deadly self-defense to repel an attack? And I think you're right, Maz. I heard the testimony about, he said, yeah, my buddy bought it because I couldn't buy it, but I could lawfully possess it. But all of that is entirely beside the point.
And in this case, because I agree with you, I was talking to my wife and I was talking to my kids about it. Legally speaking, they went through the case. And like you said, it's really hard to prove that he didn't feel that he was defending himself in that case. So legally speaking, it seems like the jurors did what they were instructed to do, and they said, no, it's beyond a reasonable doubt. We can't say that this was not self-defense. But there are a few issues that come into play, and I saw Tehran, you did an Instagram post about it. Number one, the racial issue. Is the argument that people are making on the left that if Kyle Rittenhouse were just black or brown, he would have been found guilty regardless? Or what are they, what's that? What's going on right now? What's that argument that's being had?
Yeah, so, I mean, depending on what team you're on, because one of the sad realities these days is we've become so sort of tribal that we choose up sides before a case is even tried, before we even know what the evidence will show. And, you know, some people will say, well, this was a racially charged case because it happened at a BLM protest, even though the victims were white, all three of them, I believe. It happened at a BLM protest. There was certainly some litigation early on about Kyle Rittenhouse flashing white power symbols. And so, yes, it feels like a racially charged case. And then there are others who will say, this really had nothing to do with race. It was a white guy shooting three white guys and killing two of them. It happened to unfold at a BLM protest, or really it was a protest against police excessive force is what it was really all about. So yeah, it really depends on what your frame of reference is with respect to whether you think this was a racial case or not, as compared to Arbery, which three white guys really chasing down, if not hunting down, an African-American man. It feels like for sport. And I certainly hope that jury gets it right.
And but again, if I just want to reiterate this, and I agree with you. You're saying that if the defendant were black or brown, it's not necessarily that they would be found guilty. It's just that this is, you know, again, they went by the rules of the court. And the thing that I would ask you next is, before we even get to court, there's the images of Kyle Rittenhouse after having shot these guys, walking down the street with an AR-15 as the cops or National Guard or somebody's going the other direction, and he's got his hands up. I don't know if he's saying, I just shot somebody. I don't know what he's saying, but they're just waving him away. And I think that's another argument that a lot of people are saying racially, that if Kyle were black with an AR-15, or Kyle were, you know, a Muslim dude with an AR-15, they would have stopped. They didn't even stop him. He just walked out of the scene of the crime, correct?
Yeah, if Kyle Rittenhouse were black, he would not have made it out of that crime scene alive. And I also unfortunately believe if he were black, a jury might have viewed the evidence in an entirely different way, and they might have convicted him. Because, you know, I was in the system for 30 years, and I made sure that I did my job in a way that respected everyone. You know, first and foremost, I told all my homicide prosecutors that, you know, your first mission is really to protect the rights of the defendant, protect the rights of the person you're prosecuting. You don't zealously represent them. That's the job of the defense attorney. But you do protect their rights by making sure that everything you do is on the up and up in accordance with the rules of law, rules of procedure, and precedent. You make sure your law enforcement agents do everything on the up and up. And I've had the unfortunate circumstance of prosecuting police officers when they committed crime. And, you know, that's how you honor your oath, your obligation to do justice by everybody. But I also have come to accept that the system is racist, right? If you're white, if you're privileged, if you're connected, if you're influential, you're going to be treated a certain way in the criminal justice system. If you're poor, if you have no connections, if you are a person of color, you're going to be treated a different way. That is the reality of our system of justice. And I cheered along with President Biden when, during his inaugural speech, he said, you know, racial justice, 400 years in the making, will be deferred no longer. You know, the promise of equal justice for all will be deferred no longer. I haven't seen that we've made a whole lot of headway into that problem.
And to that end, what about this judge? A lot of people were criticizing the judge on the Rittenhouse case, saying that he put his finger on the scale. And I've read the opposite, saying Well, he was doing what a judge is supposed to do. For example, one thing early on was he said, you can't call the people that were shot victims. So speak right. to that. Is there legitimacy to that?
Some of the rulings he made, I agreed with. Some of the rulings he made were unlike any rulings I've seen in a courtroom in 3 decades. So, you know, he did have his thumb on the scale for whatever reason. When he said the prosecutor may not refer to the three people who were shot as victims, I don't have a principled problem with that. Here's why. For 22 years, I tried murder cases. I didn't call my dead folk victims. I called them the decedent. It's the decedent because that's an objective term describing the person who died, the decedent. And so I understand that the term victim is somewhat loaded because the term victim predisposes or presupposes that that person really didn't do anything wrong. It's the defendant who assaulted him or shot him or killed him that did something wrong, which is what gives him victim status. But if you're a judge and you take that principled position, then you tell the other side to use a neutral term to refer to the person who was shot. So when a judge says the prosecutor cannot call them victims, but the defense attorneys can call them looters and arsonists and rioters, those are conclusory terms. And frankly, they're derogatory terms. They're slurs. You're using loaded terms to describe human beings. What's the message that the judge is allowing the parties to send to the jury? Oh, those people, they got what they had coming because they were looters and rioters and arsonists. That kind of a disparity in treatment of the parties is unlike anything I've ever experienced. That judge is ill-tempered. That judge is ill-suited to be sitting on the bench. And I hope the Wisconsin Judicial Committee, which oversees complaints against judges, digs into him for the way he handled that trial.
Wow, I didn't know that he allowed the defendants to call the other side looters and rioters and all that. That's incredible. Tehran, what do you got for Glenn?
Well, first of all, I would just like to ask Mr. Kirshner his qualifications, because I don't think that he's qualified to talk on this subject. I have friends that graduated from Google University and they have read memes and they're experts. So what qualifies you, Glenn Kirshner, to speak on this legal matter that you don't know anything about? What qualifies you?
Boy, you sound like so many of my followers who are always digging into me for some opinion or another. But, you know, I'd spent 30 after I graduated law school. I entered active duty in the 1980s as an Army JAG, where I started prosecuting court-martial cases. You know, soldiers, we honor them, we respect them, we value what they do. They also get in a lot of trouble. They commit a lot of crimes in the civilian community where they're stationed, and we have to handle that in the military's criminal justice system under the UCMJ, the Uniform Code of Military Justice. So I prosecuted soldiers when they committed crimes, both military crimes and civilian crimes. I then handled.
By the way, that's in addition to
your video. There you go. There we go. Yeah. You're back.
That's in addition to actual law. So when you have military law, it's a whole different access to American law. Is this correct?
It is. So here's what happens. You go to law school. Uh-huh. You get your law degree. You pass.
What's law school again? Can you please explain law school for all the people at Google University? Can you explain that to them? No, I just need, because
that is 3 years of having your butt kicked by law professors.
Actual law professors who studied the law and then, okay.
Let me tell you, Tehran, I was a gutter kid from Jersey, and I was convinced I wasn't smart enough to be a lawyer. And once I got into law school, I swear, I studied 28 hours a day. I read every footnote. I'm like, man, I'm never going to make it. I'm just a gutter kid from Jersey. And, you know, I made sure that I was not going to fail. And as a result, I ended up doing pretty well in law school. Then you pass a bar exam. I took the New Jersey State Bar, passed the bar exam. Then I had to go to Army law school. It's JAG school. It's on the campus of the University of Virginia in Charlottesville. It's adjacent to UVA's law school. So then I had to learn military law so I could be an Army lawyer. And then I got launched into my first assignment in Anchorage, Alaska, where I spent 3 years prosecuting court-martial cases. I then spent 3.5 years handling criminal appeals and things like espionage and death penalty cases for the Army. Basically, that's being a prosecutor in the appellate courts, right? A soldier gets convicted at court-martial. He or she appeals their conviction. I would handle it as the prosecutor, so to speak, on appeal. I did that. So after about 6.5 to 7 years of active duty as an Army JAG, I transitioned over to the Department of Justice, where I was a federal prosecutor, including chief of the homicide section in Washington, D.C. at the U.S. Attorney's Office. And I did that for nearly a quarter of a century before retiring in 2018.
So that, Glenn, sounds qualified. That sounds like you may know.
I have a question for you on that. So going back to the fact that you were on homicide cases, is there a world in which the prosecution could have come into this Kyle Rittenhouse situation and said, I don't know, second degree, involuntary manslaughter? Like, is there another thing they could have gone for? And please define briefly the differences with first degree, second degree, third degree.
Yeah.
What if you, in your mind, if you were on the prosecution team, would you have made an argument before saying, guys, there's no way we're going to win the flat out self, the first degree murder. He's going to come back homicide. With intentional homicide. You're going to come back with self-defense. Let's go for something lesser crime and at least get 4 or 5 years from this guy. What are your thoughts on all that?
Yeah, I think there was no winning this case, first of all. And I'm happy to define the different degrees of homicide. But once I saw Kyle Rittenhouse testify and you compared it to what we saw on the video, I said, you know what? Whatever else the jury concludes, they're going to have a very difficult time ruling out any self-defense beyond a reasonable doubt. It's a very high standard. And I think I went on air that evening on MSNBC and I said, based on what I'm seeing, this is very likely going to be a not guilty verdict. So the different degrees of homicide. First degree is premeditated murder, where you kill somebody intentionally after premeditation and deliberation. Premeditation is simply forming a plan in your mind. And it could be, I see an enemy across the street and I say to myself, I'm gonna get him, now's the time. I just premeditated under the law. Deliberation requires turning it over in your mind, giving it a second thought, and deciding, I'm going to do it. You can actually have premeditation and deliberation within a matter of seconds, right? But that's first degree murder. Second degree murder is a more spontaneous killing. You have no premeditation. You have no deliberation. It can just be a spur of the moment homicide. Then you have manslaughter, which is a heat of passion. You come home, you see your spouse in bed with another, you blow up and you kill somebody. That's like a voluntary manslaughter because you act in the heat of the moment. That's where adequate provocation comes in too. You were so provoked to lash out that you lashed out almost instinctively. That can be a voluntary manslaughter. Below that is involuntary manslaughter, which is like a reckless or a grossly negligent killing of another, which is like what Donald Trump did when he created so many avoidable COVID deaths. He engaged in involuntary manslaughter, in my opinion. And I can talk about the three elements of that crime. Below that, there's like negligent homicide, if you kill somebody with a car, all sorts of different definitions in different jurisdictions. But to directly answer your question, Maz, yes, you can drop down to lesser offenses. And I think the judge gave some lesser offense instructions and refused to give others. In my opinion, there was no winning this case. I mean, we all kind of mourn the result because people are dead and you feel like there's been no justice. But I actually think when you apply the law to the facts, based on what I saw, this was a legally defensible result that the jury reached.
Yeah. So this kid, in all, you know, now that we're done with the case, he... legally speaking, and all the stuff that was deliberated, we show that you could make the argument that it was self-defense, and that was the argument that won it. The thing that he did inappropriately wrong was to show up at this volatile place with an assault rifle. And I think the message that people are arguing now is they're saying now this is going to incentivize all of these other knuckleheads who are, you know, the Proud Boys and the militias and whoever they are to show up. So some guy can just show up at a, I don't know, Starbucks. I mean, we've seen pictures now. There was a guy at a Subway with an AR-15. So the guy can show up at Subway with an AR-15. The manager says, get that out of here. He goes, I don't want to. They start arguing. The manager grabs for his gun and the guy shoots. And now he's going to go say it was self-defense because he was grabbing for my gun.
Exactly the point, Maz. And I think you used the right word. This incentivizes these, you know, Proud Boys and Boogaloo Boys and Wolverine Boys, all the boy bands. And these guys, frankly, only seem to feel brave when they've got that big old assault rifle strapped across their often considerable bellies. That's when they're feeling big and brave and strong, right? Take the gun away and you have to wonder how big and bold they are. But they're going to be incentivized. They're going to be encouraged to now insert themselves into volatile situations and getting ready to use that itchy trigger finger at the slightest provocation. Because the message has been sent. If it was good enough for Kyle and Kenosha, it's good enough for me.
So my question is in regards to the precedent this has set. And first of all, let me just state that in regards to the video Maz was referring to that I did, I wanted to make sure that I also understand why this verdict was handed out. That's not my concern. My concern was the fact that if Kyle Rittenhouse was Black, brown, Muslim, or any other adverse quote unquote minority, this would have never happened. They would have never gotten there. The police would have never waved on a Bin Laden looking Jamal Rittenhouse, would have never been able to get to this point. A Black Jamal Rittenhouse would have been shot by the police as soon as they saw them with an AR-15. And we've seen numerous videos that account to this to people who are constitutionalists who basically go and test these theories. A white man walks around with a assault rifle, nothing happens, or the police come, ask him a quick question and move on. A Black man, 5, 6, 10 cops pull up, everyone get on the ground. He's arrested, even though it's a constitutional right. And there are no Second Amendment preservers who are fighting for these people. Why is that the case? Why are the Second Amendment people who are simply saying it's about Second Amendment not standing up for the Philando Castiles who legally possessed a gun and was shot by the police, not standing up for the Tamir Rices, who was a 12-year-old in an open carry state playing with a toy gun and shot by the police for not doing anything? Why are they not standing up for them?
Because at the bottom of it all, for many people, is racism and a deep-seated hatred for everybody that is different than them. And let's face it, we've always had racism. We've always had prejudice. We've always had deep-seated hatred. But Donald Trump made it fashionable, and he gave voice to it, and he gave permission to, for example, the people in Charlottesville to do, you know, the khaki Nazis to do what they did. He gave them permission. And unfortunately, hate is a far more powerful motivator than love or hunger or anything else. Hate will unify like nothing else, in my humble opinion, because, you know, Donald Trump, and I'm not trying to make this about Donald Trump, but this is why we are where we are at this moment in time. You know, he did nothing for his base, for his supporters, for the people who worship him and who for some reason credit anything out of that man's mouth. He made their station in life no better. But you know what he gave them? He gave them somebody to look down on. Because as bad as your station in life is, there are these people down below you, brown people, people of color, immigrants, you know, and you get to look down on them. So at least you're above them. That's all Donald Trump gave his base. And what did he do in the meantime? He stole from his own base. His man, Steve Bannon, created a fictitious We Build the Wall Foundation. He stole money from Donald Trump's base, and then Donald Trump swooped in and pardoned him. We don't know if they split the money. There's been no reporting on that. But this is the special evil that Donald Trump is and that he has unleashed. So yeah, why aren't Second Amendment rights people taking up? And I, let me hasten to add, not everybody who owns a gun is a racist. Not everybody who supports the Second Amendment is xenophobic or is, you know, prejudiced, but a lot of them are. And I think it's the hate and the prejudice that fuels the way they behave.
Hey guys, I hope you're enjoying this episode. I want you to know that this podcast is sponsored by BetterHelp Online Therapy. Check them out at betterhelp.com/school. We all know life is hard. There's a lot on our minds. Why not talk to a professional therapist from the comfort of your own home, from your own computer, from your own device? We take time out throughout the year to do a physical checkup. We take our car in for a tune-up. Why not do a check-in, a mental check-in, all right? BetterHelp is a customized online therapy that offers video, phone, and even live chat sessions with your therapist, so you don't have to even see anyone on camera if you don't want to. It's much more affordable than in-person therapy, and you can start communicating with your therapist in under 48 hours. Why invest in everything else and not your mind? This podcast is sponsored by BetterHelp, and Back to School listeners will get 10% off their first month at betterhelp.com/school. That's BetterHelp.com/school. Just give it a try. Let me know what you think. It can only help. Let me ask you this. By the way, talking about this Donald Trump stuff, Tehran knows I always turn episodes, and we could do an episode on Elmo and I would turn into Donald Trump. So I'm happy you did. So here's my question. Legally speaking, what could the cops have done? Because now this goes back to this idea of these guys showing up at all these riots. So vigilantes start showing up with guns at protests. Do the cops or the National Guard have a legal right and a legal obligation to clear those people out, to go, guys, you can't be here, and if you stay here, I'm going to arrest you? I mean, will they have to get into gunfights, or do they have the legal right? Like that night when those cops and whoever else was there that was part of the law enforcement, what, I know they were overwhelmed with other stuff happening because they're clearing this side, they're clearing that side. Should part of their job, legally speaking, do you know, have been to clear the guys with guns or take their guns away or get them out of there?
So a couple of different component parts to that. First of all, the police are duty bound to protect public safety. What that looks like is intensely dependent on the facts of the ground minute by minute. So there's no one size fits all answer. Like, can they just disperse the crowd by any means necessary, including tear gas and flashbang grenades and everything else? Sometimes the answer to that question is yes. If life is at risk, at imminent risk, and a deadly riot is about to, you know, burst out and hurt lots of people, then the police get to respond to that with the force necessary to dispel and disperse and to protect the safety of the community. When you get to the other piece of that is you ask about guns. Well, you know, different jurisdictions, different states have different laws with respect to what can be carried. Who can carry? Does it have to be open carry? Can it be concealed carry? And so the police in each jurisdiction will have to let the law and the facts that are confronting them be their guide. Because if you have an open carry state, guess what? You see a whole rack of people in the crowd openly carrying, they're not breaking any law. So the police would actually intrude on their Fourth Amendment right against an unreasonable search and seizure if they went up and did something that the law and the Constitution didn't entitle them to do. So, you know, it's fact dependent on what the laws of the jurisdiction are and what the police are seeing in real time with feet on the ground as to what they can lawfully do. It's not a satisfying answer, but that's kind of the nature of law enforcement.
Wow. Now, let me ask you a couple of questions on a couple other cases. First of all, we got the Ahmaud Arbery case. Yeah. What's your prediction on that? Will those guys be found guilty? I mean, some of the stuff I saw, if they're not found guilty, then the, you know, that's totally inappropriate, I think. What are your thoughts?
Yeah, there's an important doctrine called the doctrine of first aggressor. You can't be the first aggressor and then claim self-defense. You basically forfeit your right if you provoke the attack on yourself, right? So when I listen to this Travis McMichael guy testify, it became clear that he, Travis McMichael, was the first aggressor, the second aggressor, the third aggressor, and the ultimate aggressor. He needs to be convicted, as do his two co-defendants, in my opinion, based on what I have seen, recognizing I haven't seen all the evidence. Because in a nutshell, even under the friendly questioning of his own attorney, right? He prepped for it. He prepared for it. He knew what to say. Even under the questioning from his own attorney, his story didn't hold up. And then when that prosecutor started cross-examining him, she just disemboweled him, legally speaking. He has no defense. He said, look, I don't know. Maybe this guy had been stealing something from a construction site. But first of all, you don't have probable cause. Go up and pretend like you're going to make a citizen's arrest. So let's knock that right out of the box. Then he says, Arbery's running. I pull my truck up next to him and I try to get him to stop. Guess what? Arbery isn't required to stop because some yahoo in a pickup truck with his pop sitting in the back with his gun and I guess his buddy in the cab with, come on now, you don't have a legal right. Arbery starts running in the other direction. What does McMichael testify he does? He throws it in reverse and he starts chasing him in reverse. Arbery goes in a third direction to avoid what ultimately happened to him. And the dude starts chasing him in the third direction. You're now the first aggressor, the second aggressor, and the third aggressor. You ultimately get out of your cab, you retrieve your shotgun, and you shoot an unarmed man dead. You have no right to even claim self-defense. I am confident the jury is going to get this one right, assuming the jury follows the law and the facts.
Amen. What about, you mentioned Charlottesville. They're being sued. The organizers of the Charlottesville rally are being sued by members of the community. And what are your thoughts on that? Do you think that they will be having to pay something to them for the damage that they've done, that they did to Charlottesville?
Yeah, these knuckleheads are going to be sued back into the Stone Age to the extent they have any assets. The plaintiffs will take those assets. And they will probably attach any future earnings to satisfy the judgment that will be entered against them. I mean, these people, they sued a bunch of them under the old Ku Klux Klan Act of 1861 or 71, which basically allows a private citizen to bring a civil suit against a group if that group conspired to deprive them of their civil rights based on race, gender, ethnicity. And by all accounts, the trial has been a circus because, first of all, some of the defendants didn't even show up. They just defaulted because this is a civil case, not a criminal case. So default judgments have already been entered against some of them. Others stood up in the well of the court facing the jury and did things like, you can't make this up. They read from Mein Kampf.
Oh, no.
They talked about their favorite Holocaust joke in front of the jury. They're using it as a platform, thank you, Donald Trump, to spew their hatred and prejudice. So, yes, the jury is going to fine for the plaintiff and will probably hand down multi-million dollar judgments against the defendants.
And now the big case. Since we got you here, we talked about all these other cases. January 6th, there's been a lot of criticism of Merrick Garland. Why are they moving so slow? What's taking so long? I saw Don Winslow had tweeted something about how, I guess, Rolling Stone magazine did this great article showing all the connections between the people that were, you know, in Trump's orbit and helped organize this rally. And he was saying, and I guess the criticism people are saying is, why is it taking so long? Why is it moving so slow? Are they going to run out the clock? I think November 30th, they're going to review the question of, can Donald Trump turn over? Does he have to turn over all the documents? Because he went ahead and appealed it Now, once November 30th comes along and that decision is made, first of all, what decision do you think will be made? And will, if they say you have to turn over the documents, will, is there another round of appeals he can keep doing? How much longer can this guy run out the clock?
How much time do you have, Maz? So let me try to dig into all that, because my former office, the DC US Attorney's Office, they're investigating and prosecuting the insurrection cases. These are the people that I used to prosecute murder cases with. I know them well, I respect them, and I believe they're doing exactly what needs to be done, even if it's taking too long, particularly going after the funders, the organizers, and the inciters, including the inciter in chief, Donald Trump, who absolutely has criminal responsibility for inciting the insurrection. He has responsibility for being part of a seditious conspiracy to overthrow the government. He launched a rebellion on the Capitol on January 6th. He has criminal responsibility. I believe he will be indicted, but it is taking too long, because public safety hangs in the balance. Anytime I, as a prosecutor, was investigating somebody before they had been indicted, before they had been charged, the minute I had probable cause, and we have probable cause on steroids for Donald Trump to lock him up, the moment I had probable cause, I had a decision to make. Do I get the indictment right now and protect the public, or do I continue to investigate and try to perfect my case? The Department of Justice, unfortunately, is continuing to investigate to perfect its case. Why? Because nobody wants to be the first one to indict a former president who committed crimes against the United States. That is a high stakes proposition. So I understand Merrick Garland and his deputy, Lisa Monaco, who I worked with at the DC US Attorney's Office, and Kristen Clark and Vinita Gupta, all of the leadership at the Department of Justice, for whom I have great respect. They're trying to perfect their case, but I don't know that they appreciate fully the danger that Donald Trump continues to present every day he is uncharged, he is unindicted. So they need to move out on that. Let me talk about November 30th. So Tanya Chutkan is the judge, the federal judge who ruled against Donald Trump when he said, I need to hide from the Select Committee and the American people all of this deeply damaging information the National Archives has about what I did surrounding January 6th. He brought what I believe is a largely frivolous lawsuit to try to stop it, to try to delay it, and try to run out the clock. Tanya Chutkan, and I sound like a name dropper, she and I used to try murder cases against one another in Superior Court. She is a fierce, smart, really principled lawyer and now federal judge. I was in her courtroom when that case was argued 2 weeks ago, and she just banged out that case in record time. And I think the courts are now waking up and they're saying to themselves, we're done letting nefarious litigants, dirty litigants like Donald Trump, file frivolous lawsuits as a vehicle to run out the clock, right? Mm-hmm. So she, Judge Chutkan, resolved it in a couple of weeks. The appellate court set it for oral argument on November 30th in 2 weeks. They're going to bang it out quickly. The only appeal he will have left is to the Supreme Court. I think the Supreme Court will refuse to accept it for review, which means it's over. But if they do accept it for review, let's hope they do it quickly. And I always use as a measuring stick, Richard Nixon, 1974. They subpoenaed his tapes. From the day they subpoenaed his tapes until the case went through the trial court, the appellate court, and the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court ruled, hey, Nixon, give over the tapes, 4 months. It took 4 months. The courts back then understood the need to deal with these disputes, particularly an interbranch dispute when two co-equal branches of government are bumping heads. The courts understood the need to do it quickly. And the courts seem to be now back in that mindset. So I'm optimistic there. I was also thrilled to see Steve Bannon indicted, and he did his little performance art outside the courtroom, but he's going to be convicted in 30 minutes when that case gets before a DC jury, because he has no defense, none, zero. This is all another grift by him. It's a calculation. He loves the publicity. He has no legal defense for defying a congressional subpoena. I believe, Maz, we're beginning to slowly creep toward justice, but I maintain that when you've got three jurisdictions primarily in digging into Donald Trump's crimes, New York, Georgia, and the feds, you know, unfortunately, we're not looking at a tortoise and a hare. We're looking at a tortoise and a snail and a sloth. All three are like creeping toward justice. Nobody wants to be the first one to indict because that's where that white hot media glare is going to be. I predict everybody's going to want to be the second one to indict because then they're going to be like, oh man, Trump committed crimes in my jurisdiction too. So I got to get on this indictment train, you know? So it's coming. It's coming. It's way too slow. We've waited way too long, but it is coming.
What a mess. It's like watching the movie, the Titanic. You keep looking at your watch. You're like, this is a long movie. Or I guess, or the Titanic itself. It's so slow. You're like, just get the guy already. Oh my God. Oh, and what about these January 6th guys? They're now giving them sentences. Do you think they're giving them long enough sentences? The shaman was just recently sentenced. I mean, are they getting what they deserve or is it too little or too much?
Yeah, here's what this is trending in the right direction. Judge Royce Lamberth in federal court right down the street here in D.C. just sentenced Jacob Chansley, the so-called QAnon shaman, what a stone-cold clown this guy is, to 41 months in prison. And it's important to remember, he didn't assault a police officer. He didn't damage or destroy any property inside or outside the Capitol. Now, yes, he tried to damage our democracy, and that's no small potatoes, but he didn't otherwise commit the crimes that some of these other insurrectionists committed. And he was sentenced to 41 months in prison. That's a sign of things to come with these other insurrection cases. The sentences will begin to tick up, particularly with respect to people who did assault police officers and who did destroy property once inside the Capitol. So again, we're trending in the right direction. And one more judge that we need to keep our eye on, Judge Amit Mehta. He just went on record at a sentencing a couple of days ago. I just did a video about it, where he said to the American people and to Donald Trump and to the Department of Justice, the insurrectionists, these defendants, were Donald Trump's pawns. Trump and his allies did this and were not dealing with it. And that was this shot across the bow from the federal judiciary, because they get Donald Trump's culpability. We get Donald Trump's culpability. Congress, all of the Democrats and some of the Republicans like Liz Cheney and Adam Kinzinger get Donald Trump's culpability. So that's why the Department of Justice needs to stop perfecting its case and move out on indictments.
Amen. And talk about a shot across the bow. The lawyer who was defending the shaman afterwards gave a little press conference, and he was like, I don't know what he was saying. He was saying something like, you know, Donald Trump, you really fucked these people up. Like he basically was telling Donald Trump, he goes, you got to take responsibility for all these idiots that you riled up, including his own client, who clearly, I mean, these guys have mental problems, you know? Yeah. Tehran, what are the questions you have for Glenn? We're going to let him go in a minute because this has been like a masterclass. I love it. I feel like I'm in law school. This is fantastic. Thank you, Glenn, for joining us. Go ahead, T.
I do have some Rittenhouse questions. First of all, Rittenhouse, a lot of people talked about the gun not being long-barreled, not being short-barreled, but long-barreled. How did that play? Like, just having that AR-15 underage, it seems pretty self-explanatory when you're charged with the concept of having a dangerous weapon underage, right? So that was like count six, possession of a dangerous weapon by a person under 18. It looked like a dangerous weapon. Why was it not?
The judge ruled, and I don't know all the ins and outs, but the judge ruled, I believe, that there was a technical deficiency in the evidence that was presented by the prosecutor with respect to the barrel length. So it didn't qualify under the Wisconsin statute that was used to charge it. I think I got that right, and I apologize if I didn't. So the judge granted a motion to dismiss that count for an evidentiary deficiency. And I'll tell you, Tehran, this happens all the time in court. I have been on the losing end where I return an indictment on 10 counts and one is deficient for some specific factual reason. Sure. Once the evidence all comes in and I just have to suffer the dismissal of that count. That's not all that unusual. It's just that everybody is paying attention to it now because we feel like, are you going to hold Rittenhouse accountable for nothing when he did so much wrong? And that's why I think we're all so dang frustrated.
Yeah. And then I want to know, what about the failure to comply with an emergency order from state or local government? There was a curfew at 8. This kid was walking around. It was around midnight.
Doesn't deprive him of the right to defend himself is the bottom line. Yes, there were probably other minor misdemeanor technical offenses that could have been brought. But the other thing I had to decide as a prosecutor is, when is too much? When does it seem like piling on? Because if I have somebody who killed a couple of people, but then I have 3 or 4 relatively minor misdemeanors, I'm probably going to let those go because I want to focus on the crime of violence if I think I have enough evidence to convict.
So how is his mom not in trouble for reckless endangerment of a minor? She drove across state lines from 20 miles away and was like, hey, kid, have fun, son. Well, be careful of those BLMs and the Negroes. Like, I need to understand that mindset. Isn't that something?
Let's put it this way. If there are crimes that she committed, I hope the authorities are pursuing that right now. I mean, it ain't over till it's over. If there are additional charges that can be pursued, they ought to be pursued. Again, I think the prosecutor was right to focus on the deadly violence and try to, you know, hold Rittenhouse accountable for that. But if now there are other lesser crimes by those who assisted Rittenhouse, then I think those crimes ought to be brought. And I hope the authorities are looking at those.
Holy moly. Well, listen, Glenn, first of all, let me find out from Tehran. Tehran, what did you learn on this episode?
I learned not to be black or brown in the United States of America.
That's a good lesson. I learned that I'm happy I didn't become a lawyer because it just moves so slowly. I couldn't stand it. Comedians, we do 15 minutes. We get off stage. We're, you know, having a drink. We're done. But you guys, Glenn, are amazing. Justice Matters. How do people find Justice Matters on YouTube? That's your show.
Yep. Just to put my name in there, Glenn Kirshner, Justice Matters.
Great show.
Thank you. I put a new video up every day. I'm going to turn my attention to it right after we're done here. I try to analyze the legal issue of the day that is important to people. And we do it 7 days a week. It's an all volunteer effort here. Just me and my beautiful wife, Niloufar, who sends her best. And then otherwise, you can find me over on Patreon. That's where we gather together as Team Justice and we work democracy projects. We have a bunch of them that we're working on right now. I'm on Twitter all day and night trying to answer legal questions. So, you know, pretty much Google me and you'll find me on any number of social media platforms.
And for those of you listening, his name, G-L-E-N-N, two N's, Glenn and then Kirshner, K-I-R-S-C-H-N-E-R. And is that the Twitter is at Glenn Kirshner, right?
Glenn Kirshner 2, at Glenn Kirshner 2. I had to put a 2 on the end because when I tried to create my...
There was Twitter another Glenn Kirshner!
No, I screwed it up like 3 or 4 times and that one finally stuck, so.
Well, I'm happy you're on there because you answer my questions a lot too. I follow you on Twitter. I love you on Twitter and I love you and your wife in general. We're looking forward to seeing you when we come out to DC. Thank you for taking the time for being with us today, Glenn.
Thanks, Maz. We're going to mob up in the theater when you play DC, I'm telling you.
Let's do it. Thank you. That was exciting to have Glenn Kirshner on Back to School with Maz Jobrani. Thank you for listening to another episode of Back to School with Maz Jobrani. We hope you're enjoying it. We hope you're having fun and we hope you're learning something. So make sure to let your friends know, share it on iTunes, share the clips from YouTube. Just get it out there. However you're listening, let your friends know to tune in to Back to School with Maz Jobrani.
Back to school.